On This Week in Enterprise Tech, is ransomware starting to impact people's lives? Well, how should health organizations actually handle this? We'll talk about it. Plus, Curtis takes us through an interesting topic related to how organizations are communicating and their cultural differences in different parts of the company, and getting over the security to business communication gap in DevSecOps. Plus, have you been wondering about enterprise storage innovation and how it's impacting organizations and data centers? Well, we have a great guest, Mark Nolan. He's technology manager over at Kingston, and he's going to take us through the next generation enterprise cloud storage and how data centers are implementing it. Shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing your employees simple and secure, even when you're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 412, recorded September 25th, 2020. How solid is your storage? This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Salesforce Service Cloud. Salesforce Service Cloud is the world's number one customer service platform that empowers organizations to deliver service from anywhere, from home, in the office, or in the field. Go to bit.ly/Salesforce for Service to find out more. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter code ENTERPRISE. And by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is the senior editor over at Dark Reading. Curtis, how are you doing down there in Florida?
Doing reasonably well. I've been on vacation all week, so I've been relaxing by doing big chores around the house, and now starting to ease my thought processes back towards the world of security. So I'm just sitting here thinking paranoid thoughts while we're doing Twyatt on a cool Friday afternoon.
Fantastic. Now, I just got done with Ignite, but you have Interop coming up pretty soon, right?
We do indeed, and lots of good stuff happening. As a matter of fact, one of my blips is covering the something that's going to be going on at Interop, so a little tiny taste of what people can expect. It's going to be, I think, a great conference, lots of great knowledge. And, you know, in 2020, I think the closest we're going to come to a great live event.
Thanks for being here, Curtis. Well, speaking of great knowledge, we not only have Curtis Franklin, but we also have our geek in paradise and our packing mogul, Mr. Brian Chiebert. How are things going down there in the great state of Hawaii?
It's good. It's a bit dry. We've had a lot of dry weather for a while, and we had a brush fire. We're still not quite sure what kicked off the brush fire behind the university. It's on an area called Wa'ahila Ridge. The last couple we've had have been from people hiking and flicking cigarettes, so please don't do that. Obviously, the Northern Californians know all about that. They have real big fires. We have cute little ones, according to Tim Titus. But yeah, packing, lots of packing, painting, trying to get the house ready to sell.
Fantastic. Well, speaking of busy, we've had quite the week in the enterprise. Have you thought about just how cyber threats are actually impacting people's lives? Well, We have some continual coverage on a recent ransomware attack and just how it's impacted people's lives and raises a lot of questions for people. Plus, has your organization thought about trying to get over that security to business communication gap that's out there for DevSecOps? Well, Curtis is going to take us through some of that. Plus, have you been wondering about how enterprise storage innovation is impacting organizations and data centers? Well, we have a great guest, Mark Nolan, from technology manager over at Kingston, and he's going to take us through some of the latest advancements and just how organizations are taking advantage of them. But before we get to all those exciting things, we have to get into this week's news blips. Now, broadband is a big topic these days. The internet industry has competition challenges in many parts of the Americas. Now, a long history of private infrastructure ownership has enabled the breakdown of a healthy competitive market in many regions. And in its place, a series of local monopolies and duopolies actually exist. Now, this problem has been so persistent due to the fundamental fact of how we deliver connectivity using physical wires in many cases, which were installed over a decade ago. Now, these wires and their owners play a vital role in the problem, but they may not be the solution. Now, what if there was a way to unshackle Americans from the need for physical wiring? Well, what could be the possible future here? Well, these are the questions the folks at SpaceX Starlink seem to be taking very seriously. Now, the company has launched hundreds of novel satellites into low orbit and plans to offer a new kind of broadband. The service is currently in private testing. In fact, they're actually testing it in my area of Washington. And if it all goes to plan, many will launch more widely sometime within the next 6 months. Now, when it goes widespread, it's likely to change some things. Now, there are thousands of cities and towns in the U.S. that are caught up in a complicated ordeal. It's a deceptively simple one, actually, in these areas. Local broadband competition is nearly non-existent. Now, SpaceX's upcoming LEO broadband solution still has much to prove from a technology standpoint, but suppose the service truly delivers on its core pitch. In that case, it is going to be irreversibly changing the status quo that has existed for more than a decade in the broadband industry. Now, the interesting thing about the broadband cost today is that there is a meaningful correlation between the number of providers servicing a given zip code and the average lowest price plan in the area. In fact, there is an average pricing drop by nearly 40% in communities with 10 or more broadband providers to choose from compared to those with only one choice. Now, if Starlink, which is touted to be have broadband level performance, were to become available for consumers in many low competition areas, it would represent the first meaningful change to the competitive landscape in many, many years. Let's just hope this is the case in the near future.
It's a case of classic good news, bad news. Malware attacks declined but became more evasive in the second quarter. A new analysis of malware activity during the second quarter of this year uncovered these mixed results. While malware detections in quarter two decreased 8% compared with the previous quarter, attacks involving malware that were not detectable by signature-based antivirus systems jumped 12% in the same quarter. Some 7 in 10 attacks that organizations encountered in Q2, in fact, involved malware designed to circumvent antivirus signatures. WatchGuard recently analyzed malware attack data gathered from nearly 42,000 of its Firebox appliances at customer locations worldwide. Together, the devices blocked more than 28.5 million malware samples, representing some 410 unique attack signatures. That's a 15% increase from Q1. According to the company, the biggest takeaway from the analysis was the increase in attacks involving malware variants that use so-called packers or cryptors to evade detection mechanisms. WatchGuard's analysis also revealed an increase in JavaScript-based attacks last quarter compared with Q1. Now, as has been the case for some time now, attackers continue to heavily use Microsoft Office documents and files to conceal and distribute malware. Malware still remains a major cause for data breaches, but the number of breaches resulting from malware infections has been gradually declining in recent years. According to Verizon, compared with 2016, when Trojan-type malware accounted for nearly 50% of the breaches that they investigated, last year the number was only 6.5%. Much of that decline, Verizon says, has to do with improved enterprise defenses.
Google and Apple have taken steps this year, they say, will help users shield themselves from hundreds of companies that compile profiles based on online behavior. Meanwhile, other companies are devising new ways to probe more deeply into other aspects of our lives. In January, Google said it would phase out third-party cookies on its Chrome browser, making it harder for advertisers to track our browsing habits. Publishers and advertisers use cookies to compile our shopping, browsing, and search data into extensive user profiles. These profiles reflect our political interest, health, shopping, behavior, race, gender, and more. Tellingly, Google will still collect data from its own search engine, plus sites like YouTube or Gmail. Apple, meanwhile, says it will require apps in the forthcoming version of iOS to ask users before tracking them across services, though it delayed the effective date until next year after complaints from Facebook. A poll from June showed as many as 80% of respondents would not opt in to such tracking. Oh, blah, 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 blah. The bottom line is that context-sensitive location information is certainly a holy grail for the marketing industry. And as long as this kind of thing sells product, we're going to see a world like what we've seen in science fiction, where consumers are bombarded by targeted ads as they walk around their daily lives.
You may have heard of the recent news about Google versus the Justice Department. Well, the Justice Department is expected to bring an antitrust action against Google in the coming weeks. The action will focus on its dominance in online search and whether it's used to stifle competition and hurt consumers. Now, the department also is examining Google's online advertising practices as well. Now, antitrust officials at the department briefed the state attorneys general Thursday on the planned action against Google, seeking out support for states across the country that share concerns about Google's conduct. Now, the anticipated lawsuit against Google could be the government's biggest legal offense to protect competition since the groundbreaking case against Microsoft almost 20 years ago. Now, lawmakers and consumer advocates accuse Google of abusing its dominance in online search and advertising to stifle competition and boost its profits. Now, for over a year, the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission have pursued sweeping antitrust investigations of big tech companies looking at whether Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple have hurt competition and stifle innovation or otherwise harm consumers. Unfortunately for Google, it looks like their turn is to sit in the Capitol and defend their practices.
Well, Bluetooth security weaknesses are piling up while patching it remains problematic. The complex nature of Bluetooth continues to cause security problems for the low-powered short-range wireless technology, with academic researchers releasing a parade of new attacks against the technology in the last few months. On September 9th, the Bluetooth Special Interest Group, or SIG, issued a statement regarding two papers released by university researchers that described ways of undermining the security of paired Bluetooth devices in specific circumstances. Last month, at the Workshop on Offensive Technologies, or WOOT, conference, a group of researchers from Purdue University also showed off several weaknesses that could allow attackers to spoof a device that had previously been paired using Bluetooth Low Energy Protocol. And in May, researchers presenting at the IEEE Symposium on Security and Privacy showed off a similar attack that abuses a flaw in the specification to allow the impersonation of a paired device. The complexity of the Bluetooth ecosystem and the large number of implementations have made its security hard to achieve, while the rise in easier-to-use Bluetooth auditing tools, such as the Internal Blue Open Source Toolkit, has made it easier for vulnerability researchers to do their work. The three different attacks we've talked about, dubbed the Bluetooth Low Energy Spoofing Attack, the Bluetooth Impersonation Attacks, and Blurtooth, demonstrate that the complexity of ensuring security across the diverse connected device ecosystem has resulted in many potential implementation problems, and in some cases, specification weaknesses. The security vulnerabilities found to date can have serious consequences, but because of Bluetooth technology's short range, attacks are usually limited. Unfortunately, patching Bluetooth vulnerabilities remains difficult because security issues need to first be patched by device makers, and then those patches have to be distributed to and applied by every device owner. The result is that many devices are never patched, even when the providers issue an update.
Six people were recently indicted on allegations of paying over $100,000 in bribes to Amazon employees and contractors as part of a scheme to give third-party sellers unfair advantages on the Amazon marketplace. Among other things, the indictment says that Amazon workers who accepted bribes reinstated sellers whose accounts has been suspended for offering dangerous products, and that these workers suspended the seller accounts of fraudulent sellers' competitors. The U.S. Department of Justice today announced the indictment handed down by a grand jury in the Western District of Washington. The defendants paid bribes to at least 10 different Amazon employees and contractors, according to the Department of Justice. In one case, a 31-year-old defendant named Nishad Kunju accepted bribes as a seller-supported associate in Hyderabad, India, before becoming an outside consultant who recruited and paid bribes to his former colleagues, according to the Department of Justice. In exchange for bribes, Amazon workers baselessly and fraudulently conferred tens of millions of dollars of competitive benefits upon hundreds of third-party seller accounts that the defendants purported to represent, according to the indictment. The Department of Justice said that workers helped reinstate products and merchant accounts that Amazon had suspended or blocked entirely from doing business on the Amazon marketplace, and that the fraudulently reinstated products included dietary supplements that had been suspended because of customer safety complaints, household electronics had been flagged as flammable, consumer goods that had been flagged or intellectual property violations, and other goods. These fraudulently reinstated seller accounts, including ones Amazon had, quote, suspended for manipulating product reviews to deceive consumers, making improper contact with consumers, and other violations of Amazon seller policies and codes of conduct, according to the DOJ. The previously suspended merchants made over $100 million from Amazon sales after their baseless and fraudulent reinstatement, according to the indictment. The scheme started no later than July 2017 and continued until September 2020, the documentation on the indictment. So this is actually pretty similar to a scandal back in the 80s where computer resellers and consultants were bribed to push certain brands to the exclusion of others. The bottom line here is that greed will continue to game the system.
It seems like the season of service disruptions. Google users experienced a widespread service disruption for just about an hour on Thursday evening that affected the company's email, YouTube, and Google document services. The outages seem to be focused around the eastern coast of the United States, according to the Down Detector website. Now, Down Detector has heat maps for both Gmail, YouTube, Google Drive, Google Search Engine, and other Google services, and it showed a significant number of people having trouble accessing these websites starting around 8:50 p.m. Eastern. Now, the services seem to be working generally around 10 p.m., so that's roughly over an hour. Google did not provide a reason for the disruption. Now, the company is investigating the cause of the outage and has ruled out a cyber attack, according to a person with knowledge of the situation who wasn't actually authorized to speak publicly. Now, the disruption raised anxiety among people already tense about technology rules as it rolls ahead of the November 3rd election and the heavy dependence on online service for education, work, and entertainment during the COVID pandemic. Now, the outages also seem to affect corporate customers of Google's cloud computing service. They rely on technology giants for its computing infrastructure. So that's a big problem. Now, the loss of online educational services like Google Classroom, used by many people forced to study remotely, was particularly a source of an anxiety attack there. Now, the good thing here, around 10 p.m., the issue was resolved. But this is just evidence that even large giants like Google will continue to struggle with the new norm and increase traffic. I just hope that retailers will soon catch up to them and be on par with the internet giants, at least their close reliability. But I think that just might be wishes. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Salesforce Service Cloud. Now, you all know that I am a CRM guy. I am the CRM guy because I can tell you here that there is a reason Salesforce Service Cloud is the world's number one customer service platform. It really does empower organizations around the world to deliver the service that they want from anywhere at any time. Now, there's lots of uncertainty nowadays. Salesforce Service Cloud wants you to be prepared during these unknown times, and they understand that you're trying to do more with less resources. Plus, you're trying to adapt to new customer needs and innovating your business to respond to the current environment. So the goal here is to satisfy your customers, right? That's why you look for platforms that easily meet their needs. Now, Salesforce provides turnkey solutions, but they also support out-of-the-box to fully customizable support. Customizations and platforms are really near and dear to my heart, and Salesforce does it very, very, very well. Now, it really helps you find the best solution for your customers at the right time. Now, Service Cloud allows you to rapidly respond to customers on any channel. Think about all the channels you have. You have chat, SMS, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, and more. From home in the field or remotely at the office, you can provide instant support with self-service portals as well. You can connect customers to articles, account information, and even community members to find answers instantly. Plus, work smarter with built-in AI. That's why embedded AI-powered chatbots help resolve customer issues even quicker. Now, give your service team the tools to provide an unforgettable customer experience. Resolve cases faster while using the suite of intelligent productivity tools. Plus, you give agents complete shared view of every customer and interaction from then on. Now, utilize the capabilities of personalizing every customer conversation and allow them to actually always respond with the right level of service. Now, built on a fast, flexible platform, Salesforce Service Cloud enables trailblazers to provide a world-class service anytime, anywhere, whether it's messaging, chat, phone, self-service, or even in person. Over 150,000 companies keep their customers happy with Salesforce. Provide your customer service agents with a fast and flexible service platform that keeps them and your customers happy. Go to bit.ly/Salesforce for service to find out how the world's number one service platform can help you grow your business. That's bit.ly/Salesforce for service. And we thank Salesforce Service Cloud for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, you know, we've talked a lot about this before, but cyber threats are actually impacting people's lives. Brian, how much are they impacting them?
Well, in this case, we covered the story about how a hospital in Dusseldorf, Germany, got hit by ransomware, apparently by accident, because the hackers were apparently going after the university and didn't realize they hit the university hospital. Now, we obviously covered this before, but this is going a little deeper. One, the German authorities are investigating the unknown perpetrators on suspicion of negligent homicide. Let me say that again, negligent homicide. So now, you hackers out there, Germany is going to do negligent homicide because a person died. Now, the reason why the person died apparently is because the ransomware took down services to the point where it affected the emergency services at that particular hospital. And as a result, the ambulance carrying the woman with a life-threatening condition had to reroute to another hospital 20 miles away. She died. That's what makes it negligent homicide. Now, one of the other things that's happening is that, they managed to get through Citrix. Okay, now, I'm not singling out Citrix. It's a great product. All this virtual desktop interface or virtual app interfaces, they are different. You know, one, you have a full desktop. One, you're only exporting the app. A lot of these systems have the ability to isolate the app, isolate the desktop. And I got a sneaky hunch when we start looking at the details on what this attack entailed that there was probably a vulnerability that got missed. Anyway, what I want to do is, one, I want to go and ask Kurt. He's been following this attack. He actually wrote some articles for Dark Reading. Want to know if he's gotten any kind of updates. The other thing is I want our tech folks to go to the second URL. The emergency services in the United States, there are very, very strict rules. And I did a little bit of poking around. Germany has very similar rules on what conditions will trigger a redirect. And one of them, obviously, is being able to get to pharmacology. Another, because if the physicians and nursing staff cannot even open the drug safes because the network is down, that instantly closes all emergency services. Another one is if you can't, you cannot pull patient data, that'll also say you cannot admit. So there's a lot of things that can cause this. So I'm going to kind of ask Kurt, does he have an update? Have you been able to poke around and find more details on this story?
There really aren't a whole lot of updates right now. I know that German authorities are looking for the perpetrators with great intensity. This has all the signs of a heist gone wrong, because as we've pointed out here on Twyatt, the ransom note wasn't directed to the hospital. It was directed to the university that the hospital is affiliated with. And as soon as authorities contacted the perpetrators through the mechanism they had given to pay the ransom, they immediately sent the decryption key. Unfortunately, in the case of this one woman, it was not in time to keep her from being redirected with fatal consequences. This is a terrible situation, although I will say it was almost inevitable, because criminals have been targeting healthcare networks and institutions for the last 12 to 18 months because they know how important it is to these organizations that they have access to their data. And they know that rather than taking the time to work on a decryption algorithm, they would much rather just go ahead, pay, get back online, and then clean up afterwards. So I don't have a great deal of new news. I'm looking forward to seeing where this ends up, whether this especially is going to be a local German crime, in other words, a German group of hackers that went against the university, or whether it's international. That's going to be one of the more fascinating aspects of this, because that's going to have consequences in terms of how the legal case is developed.
So one of the things I want to ask Lou, you know, we've been dancing around for the last couple of decades, moaning and groaning about how we've had snake oil salesmen, shall we say, in our industry, going around doing really poor work, and then other people that do have the talent have to go in and fix it. I can't tell you how many times I've had to do that. The reality is there's been lots and lots and lots of conversations, even in Congress, about creating a certification system of some sort. Obviously, the financial ramifications would be amazing. It would be stunning for the industry. Lots of things would actually scream to a halt. So it's a double-edged sword. But when we start having things like this happening, there are some things that come up. And the thing that I want to bring up is auditing standards. There is a set of standards for the Department of Defense for any industries working with the Department of Defense on auditing requirements. And they are very strict and have some really wild penalties associated with them. I'm going to ask Lou, what do you think? Is it time for any portion of our industry that has life potential situations, is it time for a stronger set of auditing rules and maybe some new laws with stronger penalties associated with them? Lou, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think, think about it. I mean, with privacy and security rules today, they think of HIPAA, right? This kind of revolutionized the healthcare industry and how they handled the flow of information. And I think, if you think about how ransomware and other things that are related to security are impacting organizations like hospitals and other healthcare organizations. People might not necessarily be stealing the information, but it's still impacting it. So whether, you know, HIPAA or other potential acts that kind of required by law for organizations will change, I still think there needs to be change, definitely, because not only will there be, you know, higher fees and higher requirements around that, but that means that organizations won't be able to operate, using technology to store this data without following these rules. So I definitely think there needs to be some switch or some movement in that direction, because obviously this will continue to happen, and the organizations will continue to kind of drag their feet when it comes to technology and securing things. So, pushing this a little bit farther, especially from a law perspective, will help them move forward faster and, even force them to think about what they're actually using technology for.
Yeah, I'm almost thinking, like if a firearm is used in the commission of a crime, automatically, wham, mandatory sentences. Maybe something like that needs to happen, because the other thing that happens, especially for cases of murder and things like that, those actually cross national boundaries. There have been many, many cases of the FBI working with the Russian Federal Police on going after murderers and drug dealers cross national boundaries. Maybe we need to ramp it up. This is starting to get out of control. People are losing their lives. I hope this is the only one we have in memory, but I don't think so. I think people are going to make mistakes. I think we're going to have other robberies gone bad and things like that. But anyway, I'm thinking we need to go and toss this over to Kurt, because he's got some interesting news, and we're going to talk more about security to business communications gap in DevSecOps. Kurt?
Well, this is an interesting thing, because more and more organizations are embracing the evolution of DevOps into DevSecOps, where you have software development, operations, and security all coming together into what should be a unified, seamless flow of applications. But fostering close relationships between dev and ops will ideally help the security teams if they can communicate with one another. Now, in theory, this sort of collaboration will set up a communication channel for security to educate the DevOps teams on how to transform the way they manage risk throughout the software lifecycle. To achieve these goals, there's often one huge relationship hole that security organizations neglect, and that's with the business, both at the executive level and among the business units that are the application owners. We've talked to a lot of executives who say that they try to integrate security into the development process and into the entire business process. The trouble is, to do that, they have to understand, be involved with, and be integrated into both the application development process and the business units. Now, this kind of design thinking helps ensure DevSecOps success. And Capgemini issued a report where they explained that high-performing teams are 50% more likely to embed security in the design and build stages of software development rather than the bottom-performing teams. The application owners tend to drive DevOps team priorities. So if security isn't getting their word, their wisdom, their knowledge in the ears of the application owners, it really doesn't matter, the studies say, how good the relationship is between security and the developers, because the developers are going to march to the beat set by business stakeholders rather than anything that security has to say. Now, there is a session at the upcoming Interop Digital called Making Applications Secure in a DevOps World. And in it, the speakers are going to get into the dynamics of this disconnect that can go on and how to solve it. But the question is whether the CISO should be or must be the liaison, the person to pull all this together. In many ways, doing the translation between the language of security and the language of the business. You know, this is something we've talked about on TWiET before, this bridging the language gap. And Lou, I want to go to you first. How much of this issue is cultural and how much is based around the different technologies that these different groups tend to be involved with?
That's interesting that you asked that. I think that a lot of it is cultural. Part of it is just how each organization has previously done things, or they have a current set of guidelines and processes they all already follow. So I see this a lot of organizations I work with externally, is that you'll have one organization, you know, working on a particular process and how they handle that. And then they hand it off, or even try to like cold hand it off to another organization. And what you'll find is, because of the way they handle it differently, expectations are different. And so you'll see this a lot. Like, most of it's cultural. Some of it is, related to some of the fact that these organizations have different processes. Now, technology is a big deal too. A lot of, depending on what part of the stack you're working in, whether you're, handling with customers or you're handling with, monitoring things, it's much different than the stack that you're dealing with when it comes to fixing bugs and also at what level or different level of monitoring. So, it can be related to that, but very rarely is that the main reason. I think most of the time it's due to cultural reasons.
All right. Well, culture has been at the heart of so many issues. Brian, I've got to come to you. Is this the kind of thing that can be solved by management decree? I mean, can the CISO simply say you groups must work together and everyone will salute and go off and make successful applications? Or is there more involved in bringing these groups together?
I know of many, many commanders in the military that would love to be able to mandate that people be creative and that people work together. And I've seen many, many of these young commanders fall flat on their face. I've seen it in the private sector. I've seen it in academia. I don't think it can be mandated. It has to be part of the culture. If you have a culture that, shall we say, the boss knows best, you're going to have a culture of people not chiming in. A lot of the problems that I see are those of, shall we say, passing the buck. I think that's probably the best description. It's not my problem. I'm not doing it. I'm not going to volunteer because I don't want my head cut off. So one of the things I keep telling a lot of organizations that I work with, it's like, I'm sorry, Mr. CEO, if you're not willing to pick up a broom and sweep the floor, your people aren't going to do it either. And that means if you're not willing to learn how your product works, you're going to have a problem with people saying, well, maybe not. I'd like to see more of this happening. I think it's going to be a long process. I think it's going to be a sea change required as people change, as people retire, move out. The young kids will tend to want to use the bright and shiny. The old fogies want to stay with what's been there. I think the middle management is the one that's going to make the biggest change, and they're going to have to be able to communicate both up and down the managerial stack. and it's going to require that people learn to talk. I think there needs to be a change in how a lot of organizations treat their culture, and communications is going to be the biggest part of it. And being able to go and say, don't kill the messenger. Just because someone found the bug doesn't mean it's their fault. I'm kind of harping a little bit here and standing on a soapbox because I've seen so many organizations where people are trying to do something helpful because they're still full of piss and vinegar, so to speak, and then they get their heads chopped off. So I think management is going to need to be able to show, not demand, how the culture needs to change. And I think maybe, just maybe, over time it will.
Well, I certainly hope that's the case, because there's no question that security needs to be speaking the language of the business and, of course, of the developers. And each of those groups needs to know enough of security language to be able to have meaningful conversations back with security. Well, speaking of meaningful conversations, we have a great one coming up with our guest. And to get us in that direction, Lou, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Curtis. That's right. Next up, my favorite part of the show, we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you are probably already storing data. It could be on-prem or already in the cloud, but have you been considering cloud storage? Well, think about this. Wasabi is 80% cheaper than Amazon S3 and significantly cheaper than on-prem storage. Now, typically you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the annual cost of the maintenance fees on the same amount of on-prem storage. So think about that. Now, Wasabi's disruptive price performance model makes buying cloud storage a natural addition. Now, in fact, if you're a managed service provider, Wasabi is a perfect solution for you to sell, because you can earn more while charging less. Now, there are two ways that you can pay here. You can pay as you go, or you can pay one time with their reserved capacity storage. Now, Wasabi's reserved capacity storage makes buying cloud storage a natural addition to your on-prem storage. Now, if you're thinking about buying more hardware storage compared to the price of against 5 years of reserved capacity storage, because you can purchase cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments and achieve greater discounts for term and capacity. Now, with Wasabi security, it's often even greater than on-prem storage. So think about that. Now, it provides 11 nines of durability, and this means that on average, you'll lose one file every 649,000 years. Now, basically not going to lose a file there. Now, hosted in premier tier 4 data centers facilities, as well as highly secure and fully redundant, the Wasabi is secure by default because all the data stored in Wasabi's cloud is always encrypted at rest, even if the requesting party doesn't actually specify encryption. Now, Wasabi allows and follows industry best security models and design practices. In fact, they have access control mechanisms such as bucket policies, and access control lists can be used to selectively grant permissions. Now, your data will be immutable, which means it prevents data from being erased or altered, and you'll be protected from hackers, malware, and even yourself. That's right, because sometimes you delete things, right? Now, Wasabi has active integrity checking, where all objects are stored and checked for integrity every 90 days. Plus, if you're worried about compliance, get this. They're HIPAA, FINRA, and CGIS compliant as well. And Wasabi is not just highly secure, disruptive technology that's turning the industry on ear. It's actually storage that's 80% cheaper here and up to 6 times faster than the speed of the industry leader that's out there right now. Now, if you're ready to reduce your COGS and get all the things you need from performance, compliance, and security, go try Wasabi right now, because it's really time to build something, right? Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure you use the offer code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Mark Nolan. He's a technology manager over at Kingston. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Thanks for being here. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey and what brought you to Kingston?
Let's see, really short. I started off, unlike Well, there's actually more than you think. People with art backgrounds getting into technology, but I have a degree in painting, but I was doing computer art, and I think one of the standards is what was your first computer, and mine was a K-Pro 286 16 hertz with a nice. The monitor was a Sony Pro monitor, full 720 by 46 resolution, with a wired tablet and pen for drawing, and it had the Target Tip software back in the late 80s. It kind of went from there, just getting into Photoshop, compositing, 3D animation, started doing visual effects, working in television, film, doing visual effects work and editing, and then ended up doing a lot of visual effects around architectural visualization, and ended up getting hired at Autodesk for a while, helping to help all their customers with 3D animation, visual effects tools, and then eventually going to Fusion.io, where we, you know, built the sort of data center backbone for a lot of, you know, Facebook, Spotify, services like that. We got acquired by SanDisk. A year later, we got acquired by WD. WD is very much into selling hard drives, so I had to go somewhere where there was flash. And now I'm at Kingston. Kingston is all about flash memory and computer memory. And I never realized as much as I knew about them before working there, but it's a fantastic company. They're privately held, and it's kind of fun to be off the grid of large public companies where they have different motivations and are driven by stock price for their business. Right.
Now, it's interesting. Coincidentally, you know, a lot of the experiences you described, especially in the entertainment business, a lot of that requires a lot of storage. So it makes sense for where you ended up. Now, it's a big deal. In fact, I'm even seeing in the consumer drives recently a new NVMe drive hitting the 8 terabytes in the market recently. So it's pretty big. But enterprise is kind of a different story here. Now, some data centers, most data centers obviously need reliability, scalability, performance. What kind of trends are you seeing that are in the industry around storage, especially in the enterprise space?
Well, so, you know, the Kingston's aimed at the sweet spot of where people are at. And, you know, we're selling more and more NVMe, and I think that, you know, currently, if you look at all the legacy servers that are out there in the world, the bulk of them have, you know, if it's a data server, a lot of them have anywhere from 8 to 24 SATA or SAS bays in them. So SATA and SAS are still kind of king if you're buying drives right now. But if you are looking at, if you're a data center or you're looking to put machines into a data center, you're most likely looking at buying new servers that support NVMe, either in M.2 or U.2 or ruler type form factors. And so I see, you know, a lot of people are still buying servers currently that might support SATA drives, but I think the trend is in the last half a year to a year has been kicking over where everybody's looking at the bang for the buck with NVMe. And I think, you know, 18 months from now, the U.2 and M.2 and ruler will be the standard when anybody's looking at purchasing a new server.
Now, it's interesting or not, like, especially in those form factors, you know, in fact, U.2, there's been a lot of advancements here around obviously being able to build these things cheaper so that data centers can actually purchase more of them. Because a lot of times it is due to to actually cost, cost and reliability. A lot of data centers can, you know, consider, oh, well, we can go buy, you know, 100 devices of these standard, you know, conventional disks for, you know, comparably to purchasing some of these other, you know, SSD or, you know, U.2 devices. What are we seeing here? Like, what is changing and what has even been, you know, recently launched that can maybe impact this and make it better and make it easier for data centers to make that choice?
Well, so one of the big problems with, you know, NVMe drives are PCIe devices. SATA and SAS, hard drives and SSDs are still, they speak a different protocol, so they don't require the same resources in a computer that an NVMe drive does. So being a PCIe device, you know, most M.2s, like a lot of consumer M.2s are by two PCIe devices, so they require two PCIe lanes, but the typical double-sided M.2 that gets decent performance is going to be four channels. And so that's four PCIe lanes that it takes up. Mm-hmm. And most U.2 drives are four channel. There's a few that, you know, only use two, but the typical U.2 will be two lanes or four lanes of PCIe. So that means if you have four drives, that's 16 lanes. And so you can start running, you know, a single proc system out of PCIe lanes really quick by adding U.2 drives to it. And I think, you know, that being said, one controller that can control eight SATA drives can only really control half as many or less NVMe drives. And so and it's just been in the last while that the controller makers have been coming out with individual controllers. There are some tri-mode ones that actually take SAS, SATA, and NVMe drives all on the same controller.
Got it. So that helps at least, because I know a lot of Xeon processors, they support today up to 32 lanes. So, but again, like you were saying, having to take four at a time, you really reduce down the amount of drives going to be supported in that box. So it sounds like these new controllers are actually supporting more. What are some of the other things that are helping there? Like you talked a little bit about some of the new things recently about Kingston. What's Kingston launching that can maybe help with this over the course of the year?
Well, in the data center world, you know, we have three different data center SATA drives, and the main difference between them really is, you know, their durability. So if it's something where you're just storing images, you use a read-centric drive. If you're storing and refilling something constantly, if you're doing online transactions, you need something that's more durable because you're changing over the data, writing and deleting and writing and deleting. We have a mixed-use drive that's aimed at that sort of market. We do have a new product it's called the DC1000M, which is a U.2 drive. So it fits in the same form factor. The nice thing about U.2 drives industry-wide is that they can actually fit in the form factor that a 2.5-inch hard drive or SSD would take up previously. So the OEMs don't have to remanufacture all their servers in order to accommodate them. They can just change over the backplane so that it accepts NVMe. Right. You know, Kingston's been launching the DC1000M, and we've had it in the marketplace for a while. The U.2, I think, has yet to really take off numbers-wise. We still sell a tremendous amount of SATA drives. So I can just imagine most of the industry is probably similar to that. But it does seem that both M.2 and U.2 are picking up drastically in this last couple of quarters. It sort of keeps stepping up the business for that.
Right. Right. Well, we actually see a lot of adoption of this in different parts of the industry. So we'll definitely want to get to that. But I also want to bring my co-host back in. But before we get to all that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Security Scorecard. Now, with all the organizations I work with, I can tell you they're always looking for ways to audit themselves and grade their cyber risk, and especially when the way the current climate is in the ever-changing security landscape. Now, Security Scorecard is the global leader in cybersecurity ratings and the only service with 1.5 million companies continuously rated. Now, their mission is to empower every organization with collaborative security intelligence, because you are only as secure as those you work with. And as we've always said here on Twiat, you're only as secure as your weakest link sometimes, and that is your users. Now, Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. They have a patented rated technology used by over 1,000 organizations for multiple use cases. Listen to this. You can evaluate your organization's cybersecurity risk using data-driven, objective, and continuously evolving metrics that provide visibility in your organization's information security control weaknesses with their Security Scorecard rating system. You can instantly view the cybersecurity posture of any third-party vendor, partner, or supplier to help you evaluate your risk in your ecosystem. And in fact, it can also allow them to find and fix cybersecurity risks and vulnerabilities across their externally facing digital footprint. Now, with their this is with their third-party risk management. And then they also have used this for board and executive-level reporting and in the insurance space for cyber insurance underwriting. Now, Security Scorecard is always working for you behind the scenes. In fact, they have non-intrusively collected data from publicly available feeds across the internet for an outside-in perspective. Now, they have data. The data calculates scores across 10 key risk factor groups, such as patching cadence, application security, DNS health, network security, and endpoint security. In fact, an A to F grading scale helps companies easily understand and continuously monitor the cybersecurity posture of any organization. Now, companies with a C, D, or F are 5 times more likely to be breached. Now, Security Scorecard also has Atlas. It's their leading cybersecurity questionnaire and validation system that cuts through all the questionnaire noise so you can find your score to make your business more secure. Now, Atlas has a centralized platform and leverages machine learning to automate the cybersecurity questionnaire exchange process for senders and receivers, and it makes it 2 times faster and more accurate and more secure than ever before. Now, Atlas is the only platform in the market that instantly maps cybersecurity rating data to individual responses, providing a true 360-degree view of risk. Cut the questionnaire cycle in half. Save hours with 20-plus industry-standard questionnaires or their custom questionnaire wizard. Collaborate easily and securely with your team and third parties. In fact, Security Scorecard believes that every business has a right to its own cybersecurity rating. They were awarded Best Product from Security Ratings by 2020 SC Magazine Awards. I hope you've been listening, because Security Scorecard is something all organizations should be using to assess their risk. The combined power of Security Scorecard ratings and Atlas gives organizations a 360-degree view of cybersecurity for any company in the world. Sign up for your free account by visiting securityscorecard.com/twit. Check the score of your business and up to 5 others. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. And we thank Security Scorecard for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Mark Nolan. He's technology manager over at Kingston, talking a lot about industry and how there's been some changes in how storage has been developed and some of the new standards that are coming out. But I do want to bring my co-host back in. Brian, I want to throw this over to you first. You have some questions about drives.
I'm curious. I just retired from an academic environment, and one of our problems we've always had is archiving data. Now, when you started talking about read-intensive drives, that started getting my hairs up and going, what makes them different? Why are you folks labeling it a read-intensive drive? What makes it different?
So the main difference is the amount of NAND on it. So if you look at any storage device, whether it's a hard drive or an SSD, you can't buy anything that lasts indefinitely, right? They have a durability rating. And the main way to get more durability out of something using NAND memory is to put more NAND memory on it. So when I worked at Fusion.io, we had a product that we sold only to the federal government, really. And it was over-provisioned by 10 times. So it would last almost indefinitely, as far as like if you ran Facebook on it, it would probably last 15 years, which is much longer than, you know, like by the time, you know, if you had a 480 gig drive back then, that was $40,000. Now if 480 gigs, your watch has more memory than that, right? So you want it to become antiquated in an appropriate amount of time. So the mixed use drives actually physically have more NAND on board, but they're over provisioned down. So, you know, a 980 gig drive will probably have, it has about 1.3 times the amount of NAND on it that the capacity shows. Whereas like a 980 gig read intensive drive will essentially have a terabyte of NAND, and it's over provisioned by 7%. Down to the 980 gigs.
Okay, so we're obviously talking, it's sounding more expensive. So,
yep.
Yeah, okay. So if, like, for instance, I might use it for underwater observatories. If I've got to store data 3 miles underwater, I probably want to go and spend a little bit more money. What kinds of customers are actually using this? What markets justify this?
So, like, we have two read-centric model drives. One's the DC450R, and one's the DC500R. The 500R is it has actually capacitors on board for power holdup, so that makes it a little more robust. It also has a different type of NAND on it that it has more power cycle or programming cycles on it. And the mixed use one, like I said, you know, goes from like a point, you know, half a drive write per day to 1.3 drive writes per day is the difference between our mixed use and our read centric. And, you know, if you think about it, one of the other things that, I helped with an article recently that was about, you know, mistakes that people make when buying flash drives. And, you know, it used to be that people wanted to see, you know, two drive writes per day or five drive writes per day. But that was back when drives were 80 gigabytes. And that was more important. You know, if you have something like a 4 terabyte or 8 terabyte drive now, and if you're writing and deleting more than 8 terabytes of data a day, you probably are running Facebook at home or something. I mean, that's a lot of data to be creating and deleting. If you're archiving images, so if you have if you've got a telescope and you're collecting images and archiving them, you're probably going to be fine with a read-centric drive. You can go with something that's a little less robust than something that's meant to do online transactions or heavy-duty database, because you're not really writing and deleting everything. You're just storing and storing and storing. So that would be a perfect use case for a read-centric drive.
Thanks, Brian. Curtis?
Well, here's one of my questions. You know, with the speed of solid state storage, for many organizations, moving from spinning magnetic media to solid state was a competitive advantage because it allowed for much faster data access and data processing. My question is whether that is still the case or whether moving to SSD has really become table stakes for an enterprise today.
Well, are you talking about, you know, if I move from SATA to NVMe, is there, because that is about 5 to 6 times faster typically if, you know, if you have a SATA SSD versus an NVMe SSD. So if I'm talking like 550 megabytes per second read at the fastest, and then all of a sudden I go to NVMe Gen 3 PCIe, you're talking, you know, 3 to 3.5 gigabytes per second. That's significantly faster.
That is significantly
also,
faster.
Also a lot higher IOPS and lower latency as well.
Okay. Now, I think it's important that you were talking about the difference in generational speed between SSD types and SSD interfaces. The spinning magnetic didn't enter the conversation at all. Have we passed the time when an enterprise would consider spinning magnetic disk as a viable storage technology for significant applications at all? Like I said, is SSD of one sort or another the understood minimum today?
So I don't think that hard drives are going anywhere, just like, you know, people probably predicted tape would be gone 10 years ago, that we wouldn't be using tape. We're still using tape today, right? There's plenty of tape that gets archived out and sent to the salt mines every day. I think that hard drives are here to stay for cold storage because the price per gigabyte's just it's so inexpensive, and the technology is very mature and very robust, but it is very slow as well. So I do think that anything that's online, you know, SATA SSDs are a good cold storage for online. You know, if you're doing any kind of online transaction processing, and you know, Amazon has metrics for how many milliseconds somebody has to wait from when they click on something before they get bored and decide to empty their shopping cart and go look elsewhere or whatever. So you know, when it comes to things where immediacy is king, you're going to that's all probably living in PCIe flash. So NVMe or PCIe add-in card, you know, like really fast, or even DRAM for that matter. A lot of the stuff, you know, it's going to be living in DRAM or, you know, high-end Optane memory that, where you can get like something closer to DRAM speeds, closer to the CPU than even flash storage.
Well, I'm going to ask one more question because I think it's important. When you were talking about Amazon, for example, the kind of conversations that you get into with that sort of metric, you had mentioned IOPS. And IOPS becomes a more critical metric than simple bandwidth when you get into those sorts of metrics. Do you see more companies looking at IOPS when they're talking about the, web-based commerce, e-commerce? Is the conversation switching? Is it getting back to what the conversation would have been years ago when we were looking at mainframe feeds and speeds, where people want to know the IOPS more than any, you know, raw bandwidth numbers?
I think that people, you know, like SQL Server folks probably are very interested in the IOPS, but at a certain point with the, especially with SATA, you know, there's a cap on the number of IOPS that you can get through that bus. NVMe, there is a cap as well, but a lot of the NVMe drives, I mean, they significantly outperform any individual SATA drive. But I think the thing that's actually more important now than pure IOPS, because anyone can win the IOPS game because you can scale it by adding more and more NVMe drives. The real key metric now is quality of service. So I can get a really nice high-end consumer, you know, like high-end gaming NVMe drive, an M.2 boot drive, and I can get crazy NVMe IOPS performance off of that. But if it's a consumer drive, I might get really stellar performance, but at some point it takes a dump while it does garbage collection and then comes back and it'll do high performance again. But it isn't optimized for steady state, consistent performance at temperature. So like a lot of like data center drives, they use a different quality of NAND. They'll use different qualities of DRAM actually on the SSDs themselves, as well as performance tuning the firmware to give a standard of quality of service. So if you take like a high performing boot drive, you'll see that it might perform really great for a while until it runs out of its SLC cache buffer or runs out of the DRAM buffer that might be a little smaller, and then it'll tank and it'll go back up, and you'll see this spiking and erratic performance. Whereas if you look at the performance of data center drives, they'll probably perform really great, and then as they get heated up and sort of worn down, the performance will go down to a certain point, but it'll be at a steady state where once you reach that steady state, you'll just see a flat line for the most part. It might have a few ups and downs, but as it's writing, but it'll be dependable. And that dependability is something that I think Amazon and Azure Cloud and you know, those type of folks are really, their key interest is quality of service, just because they want to know the lowest performance that they're ever going to see out of that device. And if they, you know, they can scale the IOPS with as many drives as they need, you know, bandwidth wise or IOPS wise to make that their performance happen, but you can't scale quality of service by adding more drives. Poor quality of service is multiplicative, just like latency, where if you've got one drive that has a adequate quality of service and another drive that has an adequate quality of service, they don't add up to the same adequacy. They actually kind of go lower because one will always be performing poorly when the other one's up. So you want consistency.
You know, I've got an itch. I design underwater observatory IT systems. And okay. I have the NASA guys are in a different building. And over lunch, we constantly have this argument on who's designing for a more adversarial environment, shall we say. Space
versus underwater.
There's a lot
more radiation in space.
Okay. Do you have a space story for us?
We just sent some of our SD cards off to past final testing, and there's a company out of Montreal that's working to do a really cool documentary they're shooting on the ISS, so the International Space Station. We're going to have our SD cards living up there, shooting 24/7 in a VR camera rig with a big array of cameras. And it's going to be going, I think they've got a couple of the cameras, and one offloads and recharges while the other one is shooting. And so they actually record 24/7 up there. And we're moving to get our data center drives in the next gen version of that along with the SD cards that we have up there. The next batch is going up to space sometime in the next month or so.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, unfortunately, all good things come to an end. Mark, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go to learn more about Kingston, maybe some of the new offerings they have.
So Kingston.com. And also HyperXGaming.com. I've got my trying to line it. There we go. doing everything in reverse. There's our Twitter handle there. But HyperX Gaming, HyperX is Kingston's gaming brand. I've got our try not to bump the mic, but got my headset and microphone there. But Kingston makes DRAM, SSDs, and then a whole host of cool gaming accessories, it's not so much gaming anymore. I've been living with a headset and a microphone 24/7 with all of the Zoom conferences and Microsoft Teams and Skype, we're doing right now.
That's right. Thanks again for being here. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
The countdown is getting close. I'm hoping to be able to go and celebrate the holiday season with Curtis in Orlando. Lining up things like moving insurance and how to get our car shipped over and all kinds of niggly little details. But you know what? You don't need to hear about that. But I need to hear from you. My Skype, my Twitter address is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Love to hear from you. Or toss me an email. I'm Chibert at twit.tv, and that's spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. My students and I had a Dilbert naming theme. But you know what? It's probably better for you to hit Twiet at twit.tv, and that'll send the email to all the Twiet hosts. We've had lots of people throwing show ideas at us. We've had a couple of people say, well, what about this? And we'd like to hear about it. Because if you have a question, there's a really good chance someone else does too. And, you know, we always love hearing from you. Throw us a note. Take care.
Thanks, Shiver. So you don't want people, random people calling you on Skype too? Is that what it is?
No, thank you.
Thanks, Jeebert. Well, folks, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I'm going to be diving into Interop Online, so that's important. I've got a number of great articles coming up on Dark Reading and the edge of Dark Reading. So follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA to find out when those are coming up. And since Chibert's always showing off his thing, we had a mention earlier from our guest about his first computer. I've still got mine. Got a Timex Sinclair ZX81, and yes, indeed, that is the expansion 16K memory module. So boy howdy, I could just write great whopping huge apps with all that space. So there are many great machines.
Does it have a screen?
I'm sorry?
Does it have a screen? Is that plugging in anything?
Oh, a screen? No. That's what television is for. As a matter of fact, these things have the little switch down here so you can tell whether you want it to hit channel 2 or channel 3. Of your CRT, where it will display your program in its full 40-character glory. So, this is high-power stuff here. It's funny. I've left many great systems go over the years, including PDP-11 variants, several wonderful S100 bus systems, and more Intel and Windows platforms than I can shake a stick at. But the little Timex Sinclair has stuck around, and it's nice to be humble once in a while, almost as humble as the black monstrosity back there on the counter.
It's always how it is. Oldies but goodies. Thanks, guys, for being here. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show and get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch all your enterprise news each and every week. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, our show notes, our co-hosts, our guest information, and links to our stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get your helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice on any one of your podcast or applications. We're on all of them, so go ahead and listen in and subscribe. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news each and every week. Plus, it's the best way to support the show as well. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with giving the gift of Twiet, because we talk about some pretty fun tech topics on here, and I can guarantee they will find it interesting as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available, We do this 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. We do it live. That's live.twit.tv. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see all the behind the scenes. Come see all the discussions and all the fun we have here on Twit. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well. We have a really great set of characters in there. They give us some great discussion topics and some good questions. That's irc.twit.tv. Go ahead and jump in there. In fact, if you can't watch it live and you can't be part of the chat room live, that's okay. There's always a discussion going on. So definitely subscribe and go check out our 24/7 community website that's out there. There's a great set of discussions going on there right now. It's twit.community. All the hosts are out there. We have a lot of great people that have subscribed and set up accounts on there and just having a really great time discussing topics, all types of technology topics out there. We talk about all the shows. It's really a great place to be. So check it out. Come join the community at twit.community. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, I have great conversations with people like you, of course. And of course, I post sometimes what I do during my normal work weeks at Microsoft. In fact, if you want to check out some more of that stuff, you can go out, check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There you see all the latest and greatest ways for you to customize Office and make it more productive and for your organization and you. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. We continue especially to Leah and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. We couldn't do this week in enterprise tech without them. So thank you, Leah and Lisa, for all your support. And of course, thank you to all the engineers and of course, all the staff at Twit. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. Cheebert, he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And we couldn't do the show without him. So thank you so much, Cheebert, for all of your support. And before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Victor. Of course, he's behind the scenes. And of course, our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, is there nothing you can't do, my friend?
There's quite a few things. You know, there's something about that whole SQL server and all of that Microsoft goodness you talk about. Yeah, not that good at it.
That's stuff that you don't have to do. But you know what? I want to know what's going on with you in the coming year. Anything interesting coming up for you?
No, just still doing our best to create some awesome content for our Twit family and audience. But it's also football season, so I'm in a much better mood now.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ant. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twit.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and we talk about everything that has to do with Android. Is it news? Is it hardware? Is it apps? Well, you name it, we talk about it. We invite guests from the industry on the show. We even sometimes have people from the Android team themselves talking about what makes Android so great. And you could subscribe so you don't miss anything about the world of Android by going to twit.tv/AAA. We'll see you there.